final hour of your Monday edition of Justice and Drew is underway. Jason Lewis, Minnesota's Mr. Right, going to join us in about 30-35 minutes from now. I'm looking forward to tomorrow's show as well. You're going to want to stick around for that. We have a sort of a mini roundtable, like a Tuesday kind of roundtable thing happening. Tim Slagle, friend of the show, comedian, is coming to town. He's going to be at Acme Comedy Company all week for the Crash and Burn week. He's going to come in and tell us about that. Also joining him will be our friend, comedian Brian Miller.
Excellent.
A lot of fun.
Sam, you still count your steps?
I do not wear my, you mean like with a Fitbit?
Yeah.
Right? I do not wear my Fitbit as often as I should. It's not really, kind of, because my phone tracks them, but not as much as I should.
All right, so here's a pop quiz. How many steps are you supposed to, walk daily to gain any kind of health benefits?
It's supposed to be 10,000.
That's what everybody thinks.
We've all been lied. We've all been lied
to. Generally, yeah. I mean, I guess that my...
you're right, though.
But yeah, preconceived notions were 10,000.
Yeah, that's what everybody that wears the Fitbits and the Apple Watches or whatever device that tracks your steps, they all sort of settled on, you got to hit that 10,000, got to hit 10,000 steps, got to check your steps.
I kind of feel like they just picked a nice round number, but I'm okay with that.
No, it's a myth.
Yeah.
It's a myth.
Somebody picked it.
Yeah, somebody picked it.
Yeah. Yeah, big walking.
Big feet.
Yeah. You've been lied to and you bought into all the propaganda from Big Walk. Health benefits kick in at 4,400 steps per day, according to researchers.
I do that much getting ready in the morning.
Yeah, it turns out this 10,000 number is a complete myth. A team of researchers from Harvard and other leading institutions just uncovered the medical source of this alleged scientific wisdom. It was a sixth grader science project in California.
No,
I'm kidding. That was the plastic straw myth. And it came from neither a doctor nor a medical establishment nor even some cutting edge research. Instead, it came from the marketing department of a Japanese clock company 50 years ago.
I thought that it was some kind of Japanese study, but I thought that it was more
not a
medical.
Study.
No, yeah, yeah. Not
a study.
There was no study.
It was a Japanese commercial.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
How did a clock company 50 years ago benefit from this?
Well,
they were making, it was the Yamasa Clock and Instrument Company back in 1965. They wanted a name for their new pedometer. The Manpoki. Manpoki. That's what they.
Yeah.
That's what they call it. It translates.
I heard you could catch one at the state fairgrounds.
Literally. Yeah, Melinda caught one on her Pokemon Go app yesterday. It literally counts. It says literally 10,000 steps meter. That's what Manpoki means. So the legend was born.
Yeah, and according to this research done from Harvard and this, this group, they say this is likely the origin of the 10,000 steps per day goal is this jingle, basically, for the Manpoki, a pedometer made by a Japanese clock company in 1965.
The researchers say the number has limited scientific basis. There is limited information on how many steps are needed for health. Or more elaborately, an expert committee recently identified a critical gap in knowledge on the dose response association with steps with health outcomes. Translation, we don't know how many steps you should be walking every day.
I generally think that the answer is like, okay, if shooting for a 10,000 step goal every day is good for you, then go for it and do it. But it's just the fact that this has been like, you need 10,000 steps in order to be healthy.
How many senior mall walkers could have shortened their time walking through the Mall of America if it wasn't for this stupid Japanese clock company?
The answer is a lot.
A lot.
A lot.
Like all of them, right?
Like, malls
all
are basically, should just be empty now.
A spokesperson for Fitbit, of course, said, look, there's something wrong with walking 10,000 steps a day. Of course not. If you get health benefits at 4,400, then obviously 10,000 is going to benefit you. But be that as it may, if you walk 4,400, you're doing all right.
Yeah, they did a study of elderly women with an average age of 72, and they did find that people who walked more were generally healthier, generally lived longer, but they found that the significant health benefits seem to kick in around 4,400, and they top out at 7,500. So that, 2,500 steps that you're making to get to 10,000, waste of your time. Absolute waste of your time. They topped out. You've peaked out. The health benefits.
Wait, 75. That's not true.
Sit down and watch a show now.
How can you top out?
I don't know. That's what it says here.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
Whoa.
You don't get any additional health benefits.
How
are you not?
They top out at 7,500 steps, and the speed at which people walk didn't seem to make too much of a difference.
I completely disagree with that.
Well, then you are a science denier.
You can't tell me that you're getting the same amount of health benefits if you're walking 7,500 steps a day, or if you have someone who goes on like very, very long walks for health benefits. If someone goes and walks 15,000 steps in an afternoon for a long walk,
yeah.
You can't tell me that they are getting an equal amount of benefits.
I'm not telling you that.
Who is science only walking 7,500?
I feel like I'm missing something here. Does that equate just to walking, or is that like riding my bike too? Because I would be under the impression that if I go for a...
Like more is better.
Yeah, if I go for an hour bike ride over a half hour bike ride, then I'm getting, double the benefits.
Because you are.
Because you're burning calories.
You just are. Like, you just are. This article is just wrong.
I know you didn't write it, Drew. I just take issue with it. You know what? That's fake news.
Market Watch sticks to market stuff.
You are burning more calories if you walk more than 7,500 steps. So how can the health benefits tap out? Unless we've just completely miscalculated all of how working out works.
Why would anybody become a runner if that was true? Like, why would anybody become a long-distance runner?
I've been asking that question for years. Why would anybody become a runner? What do you want to be when you grow up? A runner. I want to run.
It's just like people who are actually serious about that.
I want
that.
To run free.
I go on my bike rides and I'll pass runners and I can't help but just go, you can get on one of these. It seems so harsh on your body.
You know, there's nothing chasing you, right?
Oh, this dude was trucking like somebody was, though, man. He was on a mission. Like, he couldn't even make eye contact with me. He was so in the zone.
Wouldn't it be weird if he did?
Were you trying to make eye contact?
Were you, like, going by
staring?
Trying
to have a moment?
No,
John wanted to connect with somebody on his bike ride.
Okay, I'm not going to push back against that.
Hey, friend. Oh.
Hi, friend. Hi.
I generally and genuinely try to do a wave or a smile or a hey. When I pass walkers or runners or other bikers.
Hey, brethren.
I just say, hey. Usually get
hello, brother.
Hello, fellow health-conscious person.
I also am engaging in physical activity.
Subtle head nod, hey. This kind of thing. And this dude wasn't...
Like motorcyclists often do that with one another.
Yeah, this dude's got nothing. He had nothing for me. He was... And I respected it. He was in the zone.
Did you say something like vocal... He probably had headphones in or something.
No, he wasn't. No,
he probably was in the zone. There's a certain point when you're running.
Or he knew who you were.
And just, yes.
Maybe he was actually...
It's that guy again.
He was actually running away from you.
It's the guy in the red shirt on the gray mountain bike. It's that guy again.
He always waves at me.
There's that weird wavy guy.
It is really interesting the way that people like sort of respond to that. Sometimes you get something as subtle as the head nod. I've gotten a hey friend. I've gotten somebody
hey,
who actually
friend.
Said hey friend.
Hey, hi, friend. Pal.
I really appreciated that. It's a hey friend as I went by.
We're not friends.
It's very, very special.
What do? You always say something or do you just wave?
I usually do like a hand. I can do like a hand from the handlebar, like a hey, or do like a nod or like a hi,
Hey,
buddy.
See.
You should do this. Hey, buddy.
Say it like you're a narwhal.
Hey, buddy.
Like you're a cartoon narwhal. You should
just be courteous, my fellow man or woman.
So you've been doing this for a while, I'm assuming. Mm-hmm. So you've kind of figured out what kind of reaction you get when you wave. Mm-hmm. I think that as a study, instead of waving, you should try just flipping people. if you get more of a reaction from that.
I'm not going to do that because I'm a nice person.
Just try it.
Yeah. The other trick.
Just for a day.
The trail that I go on is right next to the high school.
Okay.
In Blaine. And so often when I go on my weekly rides, the students will be out walking the trails for activity or whatever. Obviously, not going over 7,500 steps because you tap out the health benefits.
Clearly.
But when I'm riding behind them, I have a little move that I do where, because they'll block the whole walkway. They won't hear me coming. So I'll change gears on my bike to make noise. It works every time.
Or you could hey, I'm coming up behind you.
Yeah, I don't feel like yelling. So I just change the gears and see if they, and then usually they're like,
I just like yelling at people.
And there's always that frantic moment too, because they'll turn, huh. There's always, huh. Like there's... Like, they're shocked to see somebody else in the trail and they move off to the side.
This man's going
to
hit us.
You know, you guys are just jealous because my rides are so exciting.
They sound really exciting.
There's a sense of, they sound really compelling and interesting.
Adventure.
Meeting new people.
Next time you should just try hitting one of those ice cubes. Yeah. Why not?
I think about you guys every time I ride because I get out and I'll just be out on the open road just thinking, and they say that I don't go do anything.
Well,
you just don't do anything with us.
Yeah,
I do stuff with you every day.
When you show up at my door from a bike ride, where you bike all the way to my house, then I will be like, "Wow, you do do things."
All right. Challenge accepted.
Yeah.
Speaking of challenges, Amy Klobuchar wasn't having it. Star Tribune. As a three-term senator and presidential candidate, Amy Klobuchar is accustomed to fielding questions on some of the more divisive topics driving national politics.
Yeah, and she doesn't answer any of them.
It is truly...
It's amazing.
It's truly astounding.
Yeah.
How little she answers.
But recently, the Minnesota Democrat faced a query on a subject known to spark sizzling debate among voters back home. Was it the reinsurance? Was it the gas tax? Was it for light rail funding? You know, a real controversial issue. Was it Minlars? No. Toward the end of an hour-long interview on the most tedious podcast in the face of the earth, Pod Save America. I feel bad for anybody that actually listens to that. The popular podcast launched by Obama administration alums. The conversation turned to what the host should do and eat while in town for a live show here in Minnesota. She said, well, there are a lot of fun places. There's a very famous hamburger called the Juicy Lucy that maybe you've heard of. And then Dan Pfeiffer asked, do you have a preference of which of the two places? Of course, referring to the Matt's Bar 5-8 Club, both claim to be the originator of the Juicy Lucy. Everybody seems to have their favorite of which one they prefer between the two. And then she said, no, are you kidding? I'm not going to go there with you. So she wouldn't make a choice. She couldn't pick between 5-8 Club or Juicy. Like, everybody's got their opinion. And it's not controversial. Like, nobody gets in fights about it.
No. Right.
Like, nobody's going to not vote for Amy Klobuchar because she picked the wrong place to get a Juicy Lucy from, in their opinion.
Right.
She's not going to lose a single bit of support. Yet even that question was too much of a controversy for her to delve into. She is literally the senator of small things. She cannot take a stand on anything even remotely provocative.
And it's so short-sighted on her part, because had she taken a stance, the amount of, that could have been, and I'm going to really blow this out of proportion, okay, but that could have been like the thing that actually garnered her some attention. Say she, you know, depending on 5-8, right? Can you imagine, like, they would start talking about it?
Sure.
Right? And then the opposition would be like, well, you really need to come in and try ours again.
You can make a whole thing about it.
And they, this thing could have ballooned into this big...
And it would have been fun.
Fun.
And it would have been harmless.
Yes.
And it would have been fun, and it would have gotten her some positive attention, but instead she said, don't ask me to choose.
And why didn't she answer those questions? It's straight up fear. It's a fear that she has to go and take a stance on it and not be genuine and authentic because of this misguided notion that she's going to isolate a group of people. We all have to make decisions and choices every single darn day.
It's very Minnesotan of her. Like, super, super Minnesotan of her. Just indecisive, a little passive aggressive.
I bet she really tailgates.
No, because she'd have to make the decision to be an aggressive driver if she was tailgating.
She'd also have to drive.
Yeah, there's that too.
She's probably never
she gets driven around.
She's probably never even been to Matt's or 5-8.
You're probably right.
Honestly, she's probably never had a Juicy Lucy ever.
That's a really good point. Yeah. By the way, side note real quick, you gave me a really good idea. I want to see, like, get your list of your top sort of, you know, congressional men and women. And put them in cars and have them race. Because I bet most of them don't know how to, especially the long-term ones that have been there for, I bet most of them don't drive. That would be hysterical.
That would also, it might be deadly.
Yeah. It'd be bumper cars. Right? By the way, by comparison, we don't have to get into the article itself, but I just wanted to, by comparison, so there's this article, this stupid article about Amy Klobuchar not, you know, deciding which Juicy Lucy joint is better. The front page headline to this story cracked me up. Trump doesn't have unanimous support from Minnesota's two new GOP congressmen.
Yeah. Or from anybody.
Right.
I mean, when it comes to unanimous support.
Right. That was the headline.
That's the headline.
You get into the
two new congressmen are Democrats.
Well, and he...
So why would he?
Well, here's...
I mean, I assume they're referring to Phillips and Craig.
Yeah, no, the two new GOP.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah, no. It's stated in the headline. Trump doesn't have unanimous support from Minnesota's two new GOP congressmen. And what's funny about it is when you get to the actual article, it changes. Different approaches for Minnesota's two GOP newcomers in Congress. But that wasn't the way the headline was written on the front page. And I know I'm reading into it because the Star is biased. But I couldn't help but read that front page headline and not think that they were trying to be a bit clickbaity on it. I actually appreciated the fact that the article highlighted that GOP-minded individuals, conservative individuals, actually had their own unique opinions when they were talking about Jim Hagedorn and Pete Stauber. I actually appreciated the fact that the article went to show that, yeah, these guys actually do have differences of opinions, even with the president. But that headline, Trump doesn't have unanimous support for Minnesota's two new GOP congressmen. I mean, to me, that's some sort of a misguided stereotype that everybody supports Trump, and that's just on the GOP, and that's not the case. Nope.
And it never has been, nor will it ever be.
Nope.
And it shouldn't be.
No. No. All right, coming up.
I mean, that's what the Democrats expect. You know, the blind loyalty and unanimous support for whatever their leaders decide. You saw it here in Minnesota. You saw it when Obama was president.
Right. Two articles out of the Pioneer Press. We'll dive into this real quick. Boondoggle of state computer system made budget compromise possible. So apparently the failed Minlars program was what brought the tribunal together. And then we'll also give you details about how Mayor Carter says the St. Paul trash collection system will continue, even if the city needs to borrow $13 million.
BN 103.5 FM.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Welcome back to your Monday edition of Justice and Drew, about 10 minutes away or so from being joined by Jason Lewis for our regular Monday visit.
According to the Pioneer Press, if it hadn't been for an embarrassing state government computer system, Minnesota's elected leaders might be bickering today about the state budget and headed towards a government shutdown. And what they're referring to here is Walz, Gazelka, and Hortman, who last month, it seems so long ago, agreed to scrap the state-developed program and replace it, this is Minlars, with a yet-to-be-identified one developed in the private sector. It might sound hokey, but in interviews last week reflecting on the over 5-month legislative session and ultimate compromise, Walz, Gazelka, and Hortman, also known as the tribunal, doing that thing with my fingers, all said that rising to the Minlars challenge made the past several weeks possible. Walz went so far as to say, for me, the tone that was set by Minlars and the trust that got built up there shaped the entire rest of the session.
Yeah, they realized we don't need all these pesky legislators. We don't need all these representatives and senators. There's the three of us.
Right.
You know, we'll just get together. That gives me, Governor Walz, two bites at the apple. You know, because not only can I veto ideas in the tribunal, but I can also still veto them when they get to my desk later, which is pretty cool. You know, I like having two opportunities to do that.
Yeah, the more sort of nice grassy meadow version is what Walz said. He says it's what ratcheted down the animosity. It's what made compromise possible. But I'm kind of with you. That might have been the case. Okay, and that might...
I think it very much is.
A part of it as well.
Yeah. I mean, I believe every word that Walz is saying here.
But the truth is, they also figured out that this triad, this tribunal,
yeah,
also had some ability to craft how this whole thing was going to shake out, and Minlars happened to be the catalyst that showed this trio becoming this tribunal during the final days of the legislative session.
Yeah, and at some point, I think they're also going to realize that the way they did this was unconstitutional.
Yeah.
And I don't know that anybody's going to actually step up and challenge anything, but there should be, we talked about it on the show, you know, while this was all going on, We talked about it with Representative Nick Zerwas. There should be some legitimate concern that if they're going to continue down this path, if they're going to continue with this being the process, that there's going to be revolt from legislators, as there should be.
Apparently, the term is not a very welcome one to the three of them, okay? They sat in the governor's cabinet room on the ground floor of the Capitol and presided over disputes, impasses, or communication breakdowns between committee chairs from each chamber. The chairs were negotiating with each other and other influential lawmakers to reconcile the differences between the Senate Republican plans and the House Democrat plans, and there were a myriad of differences in every aspect of the budget. Walz, Hortman, and Gazelko were rarely alone in the room, as commissioners or other policy experts often advised them. But it was the three of them who would have to make the final call and later persuade their respective caucuses and staff to get on board. Sticking to a mutual promise to each other, none of the three revealed to the Pioneer Press detailed conversations on specific terms, but because they did discuss tenor, each said they think the public would be surprised at how respectful the scene was. Look, respectful or not,
it doesn't surprise me.
No, it doesn't surprise me either. Towards the end of this, they do the article, because they get into a lot more detail just about what they were debating about. And they talk about the budget, the healthcare impasse. A major impasse during the budget negotiations was healthcare. Walz and Democrats wanted to continue the tax on providers, but the monster lurking in the room, the rising cost of healthcare spending, wasn't being addressed. And none of them could agree on the best approach. The Health and Human Services budget debate is the realm of everything from welfare programs to allegations of waste and fraud to single-payer philosophy, and Hortman said that things were approaching a logjam. There's no way if we sat in the room all summer long and tried to find a way to bend the cost curve in Health and Human Services, the three of us would have been able to do it. But it was critical to Gazelka that if we were going to continue to do the provider tax, we've got to do something differently, and it was critical to the governor to keep the provider tax. Hortman threw out an idea, a blue ribbon commission to search for future savings. In general, the old political saw is a commissions and task forces are where good ideas go to die, but the Menlars Commission brought change. Hortman said she and the others made the case this way. We are very seriously going to take a run at reform, and we're going to do it together. So Gazelka agreed, and Hortman said it became the breakthrough that they needed because of the positive experience with Menlars. That Blue Ribbon Commission really unleashed meaningful work. It became a potential way out of HHS, and it worked.
Cool.
Yeah.
I guess. Look, I mean, as long as we're going to have divided government in Minnesota, this is the type of thing that we're going to have to deal with. And it's going to be, you know, get your wins where you can get them. Don't spend a whole lot of time lamenting the losses, because you're not going to get any wins in divided government without giving something up.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you are just going to have gridlock and shutdown. And there's a time and a place for gridlock and shutdown. I'm not going to sit here and say that gridlock and shutdown are 100% negative 100% of the time. They're not. You know, they can be effective. They can be used to, you know, push a narrative, to push an agenda, to force the other side into doing something that they otherwise wouldn't do. And as someone who wants to see government do as little as possible, gridlock all day, as far as I'm concerned. You know, there's going to come times when things need to get done, when bills need to get passed, when budgets need to get passed, and things like that. And when you've got divided government like Minnesota has, nobody's going to walk out of it pretty happy.
Yeah, and the fact that they had success, I think, is I know there's concern. You mentioned it. Nick Zerwas mentioned it on Friday's show. If you missed it, go to the iHeartRadio app and listen to Friday's show. I think the success is probably going to keep the rules in place for now, but this is a situation that needs to be addressed, because there is a lot of concern, and I have concern with the way that you've got, you know, and Gazelka did a good job navigating it, and I'm not blaming him, not even blaming Hortman or Walz. This is sort of the hand they ended up being dealt, but this idea of this tribunal just does not sit well.
Yeah, the constitutionality of some of the things that are passed eventually, I think, will get called into question, and then we got a real problem.
So, despite a judge's ruling, as we move our attention over to St. Paul, well, to the city of St. Paul specifically, despite a judge's ruling seemingly to the contrary, St. Paul's mayor said Friday that organized trash collection will continue in St. Paul, even if the city has to borrow $13 million from its financial reserves and raise property taxes next year to pay for it.
That's what it's going to come down to.
Man.
Man, he made some promises here.
He doubled down.
He has painted himself into a organized trash collection corner that he does not know how to get himself out of.
Mayor Melvin Carter said, trash collection will continue to operate uninterrupted in the city of St. Paul. Residents do not need to, nor should they make any attempt to secure alternative trash services.
We will take your trash. You will make no attempt to secure trash services on your own. We will handle your garbage. Do not attempt.
You did that pretty good.
And you better be careful how good you did that. Better you than me.
Nor should they make any attempt. I mean, that sounds like a threat.
Yeah, do it.
It's just that sounds ominous.
We'll face the consequences for making any attempts.
Any citizen who attempts to secure trash services on their own will be severely dealt with and consequences will be handed out.
Any non-sanctioned trash collections should be dealt with swiftly.
You're suddenly turning in a clown.
Should be banished from St. Paul, never to return. Within your trash a pile high.
We will raise your property taxes to collect your trash.
Carter joined.
This is ridiculous.
It's so stupid.
This is ridiculous. Give it up.
Even if it takes 13 millions. $13 million of dollars.
No, he said that even if it takes $13 million in borrowing and new property taxes, Carter says trash collection will continue. Residents do not need, nor should they make any attempt. It's right there.
Wow.
The mayor also.
Nor should they make any attempt to.
So we're also going to appeal. We're going to do all the appealing. All the appealing of the judge's order. So this we hope to be victorious in our plans. To only be the ones to collect your trash.
First, they came for my trash.
That's right.
And I said nothing.
And that's right.
In Soviet St. Paul, trash collect you.
Since they came for parking spots. And they came for automobiles. And now all we can do is fuck.
What is happening?
I have no idea. If the appeal fails, however, or lingers in court, oh, I can't let it linger.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Oh,
do you
no.
have to let do it linger? To? Let it linger? Yeah. Do you have to?
Do you have to?
City government may have to pay residents' trash bills through the end of 2019. An estimated $13 million will be drawn from reserves, according to Carter. The policy, the city's reserve funds may not drop below 15% of its general fund budget, and the city would be forced to recoup all of the parts of the $13 million in property taxes through 2020. You're going to pay whether you like it or not,
yep,
man.
They're going to take your trash. You're going to pay. And this is starting to sound a little vindictive on the part of like Mayor Carter and the rest of the, you know, because how dare the citizens get together and follow the city charter and put together enough signatures to try to get a referendum to let their voices be. How dare they? They have no say in this. We want your trash and we will take your trash.
We don't care how many signatures that you've obtained. No amount of signatures will undo that which has already been done. Even if you've got to 6,000, it does not matter. Opponents dubbed themselves St. Paul Trash. They did gather more than 6,000 signatures, put it on the ballot. The effort was rejected. Yeah. By the St. Paul City Council.
They followed the rules. Yeah, this is right. How you're supposed to get things on a ballot. They followed all the rules, and the city council was like, No. You will not vote on this. We will take your trash.
Don't scare.
You go away.
How many squiggly lines you put on the paper? It does not matter. Judge Castro disagreed with the city's rejection, noting the city's charter, its constitution, explicitly allows voters to pursue ballot referendums. Man, can you imagine being the individuals
who took the time to go out and gather all the signatures, knowing that you got, because that's what usually happens. You've got to get the requirement, and if you do it right, you got to get above and beyond. That way, when those signatures are vetted out, you know, you usually have quite a few that drop off, so you make sure you get enough to cover the gap if it ends up appearing. You do all that, you know you've got more than enough. You go to the city clowns, and they're like, nah. We reject your signatures.
We will not be repealing this ordinance.
Yeah. It's taxpayers versus the city of St. Paul, man. Good luck.
Yeah.
May the odds be ever in your favor.
No. Oh, yeah.
Oh, poor Jason Lewis. It's like, what has the station become since I've left?
We'll find out. We'll ask him when he joins.
0.5 FM.
Excited to be joined by Minnesota's Mr. Right, Jason Lewis, in just a moment. But real quick, I do want to announce that it was made official, announced today, that iHeartMedia Minneapolis, KTLK, and our sister station KFAN 100.3 will continue to serve as Minnesota Golden Gophers flagship radio stations for football, basketball, hockey going forward. You're going to hear men's basketball and hockey games primarily here on KTLK, football over on KFAN 100.3. Very excited and very pleased to be continuing that relationship.
Nice.
Yeah, going forward into the next few seasons.
Good morning, Jason Lewis. How are we doing this morning, sir?
Well, that is welcome news, I will tell you. I'm watching the Gophers play. You know, when I played in the congressional baseball game about a year ago now, I was proud to wear the Golden Gopher uniform.
Nice.
So that's fun to see.
Yeah, it's a great relationship, and we're very, very happy that it will be continuing down the line. How are you doing, Jason?
Doing just fine. It sounds like you guys are doing really well. If you get
that. Hey, do you have a hot take between Matt's and 5'8" on Juicy Lucy?
I'd rather not go there. I was unaware until I tuned into the program this morning that Minnesota had legalized cannabis completely. But now after listening to you two, it's pretty clear we changed policy.
What are you saying, Jason?
You guys are having fun. That's
well,
a good thing.
It's funny, and Jason, you can relate to this from a talk radio standpoint. This is what happens off the air: is that we'll be covering stories, and one of us will look at each other and go, "Like, you want to have some fun? We need to have some fun." Like, things have been too serious. Usually, it comes after like an Ilhan Omar story, where we just get so frustrated that we need to go and act a little goofy to sort of balance things out.
Do think in this era of speech code, censorship, political correctness, politically correct hell, that you've got to start mocking some of the absurdity that's coming from the left.
Yeah.
It is absolutely bizarre.
No doubt. No doubt, because they won't do it. I mean, they won't call out their own. I mean, that's the thing that drives me nuts, is you see so much infighting among Republicans. You know, you're not conservative enough, or you're not ideologically pure enough, and they'll primary you, and they'll issue all these sorts of challenges. But when it comes to, you know, just look at Ilhan Omar, you've got a lot of evidence that points to a federal felony here when it comes to marriage fraud. You've got evidence pointing to the fact that she may have committed marriage fraud, immigration fraud, to help get her brother into the United States. It happens. It's not like it's that outside of the realm of possibility. It's something that is very, very common. It's a common way to get family members into the United States. So it's not even that unfeasible.
But you understand, the goal, Andrew, is to immediately assail your criticism of Ilhan Omar or anybody else the left deems above it all, mm-hmm. and to start calling you names in order to silence you and silence that criticism. That is what this is all about, the perpetual outrage, the children of the resistance throwing up a temper tantrum at every street corner they can find because they're outraged, and the media play along instead of correcting this stuff. The end game is to make certain that there are areas in politics that you don't go.
Yes.
Right. Exactly.
And that once you do that, they've won. So the better retort, in my view, is to do exactly what you guys have been having some fun with, and that is mocking the absurdity of the left.
Well, you've pointed this out many times, and I'll just repeat what you said a moment ago. You know, the extension and the larger problem here is the fact that the media goes right along with it. And they're fearful. Well, fearful and biased, both. But they also are reluctant to go and follow up on, you know, substantial information and facts of a situation because of that same fear that they have of also getting called, you know, these particular things that individuals like Ilhan Omar like to call people that dare question, you know, or raise a question about things she may have done in the past.
It's so contrived that it's amazing. If you had a journalistic community that actually cared about the substance of the issues instead of enforcing the politically correct speech codes, then you could get to the bottom of this. But now, you know, if you want to know how bad it's gotten, folks, when the New York Times says CNN and MSNBC have gone off the rails, you know you've hit bottom. Well, so the New York Times this week said, you know, we really don't want our reporters who might have a scintilla left of objectivity, and that's hard to find at the Times. We really don't want them being on Don Lemon's show. We don't want them going on Rachel Maddow or this the lunatic Larry O'Donnell because they're partisan hacks. And our reporters will become partisan hacks. This is exactly what Ted Koppel said a few months ago. Ted Koppel, who is a, you know, frankly, a liberal.
Yeah.
But Ted Koppel would go after a Michael Dukakis because he saw himself as a journalist first and an advocate second. That's been totally turned on its head. Now you've got the networks of, you know, think about this. The network of Michael Avenatti, the networks of Jussie Smollett lecturing other people.
Well, and you could have situations, and we talked about this with Andrew Langer earlier in the show. We could have situations and good conversations of substance, like surrounding Trump and his moves on trade with China and Mexico. But even when they go and cover that, it's from a personality standpoint. It's not from an actual policy standpoint. And speaking of which, this is where we kind of wanted to lead you into. Both China and Mexico have signaled a willingness to negotiate with Washington over these escalating trade issues. Where's your head at with what Trump has been able to do so far at least bringing both China and Mexico to the table to try to hash out these issues and problems that we've been dealing with for so long?
You know, I keep hearkening back to my favorite rock group of all time, the greatest group, the group that started the revolution, without whom there would be no popular music, of course, the Fab Four, the Beatles. And they got to the point after the radicalism of the 60s where, believe it or not, John Lennon was mocking Jerry Rubin and the protests of the 60s. And their song, Revolution, was all about that mockery, speaking of making fun of folks. He said, "You say you want a revolution, we'd all love to see the plan." And every time I hear the critics of what Trump is doing on trade, I'm waiting for their plan.
Yeah.
We're running an $800 billion trade deficit. It is hollowing out American manufacturing up until recently. People are being put out of work. Industries that used to be the staple of rural communities, not just agriculture, but furniture makers, textile manufacturers, all sorts, have gone. And it's interesting to me that the knee-jerk reaction from a whole lot of people, Republicans and Democrats, is not to side with America, America first. It's to side with our trading adversaries, who, by the way, let's be clear about this, and there will be pain associated with tariffs like there is with any tax. But if China and Mexico weren't feeling more pain, why are they screaming and yelling so much about
right.
this? You are 100% correct. They know, look, you know, we talk about it all the time. Taxes influence behavior. And if you want to call the tariff a tax on the American people, that's fine. I'm not going to argue with you. You know, the end consumer ultimately pays for all taxes and all tariffs. And I have no issue there whatsoever. But that behavior will change over time, and that will create market opportunities for American made products to come in at a lower price point than what they're getting from China or Mexico. And it'll take some time.
We'd still have a net tax decrease in America with the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, a massive net tax decrease. So if indeed you replace a income tax with a smaller tariff, well, that's exactly what the founding fathers did. We didn't have an income tax in this country until the first part of the 20th century. We funded the federal government with tariffs. Now, they're more uniform, and there's an argument to be made for that. But the idea that you cannot, what the critics are saying is we can't have taxes. Well, great, let's repeal the income tax completely then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
They're not saying that, though. So think about this. Some of the critics are saying, I'd rather have a big, fat U.S. income tax on domestic companies, domestic production, than any tariff at all.
Well, and some credit where credit's due. I mean, Trump put the economy in a better place and then started making these trade moves. And that was the right thing to do. We're working and we're dealing here from a position of strength where we had not been for quite a long time.
That's exactly right, John. In fact, had you piled a tariff on top of our already punitive income taxes, that would have been much more deleterious to the economy. But once you reduced domestic taxes, you had some leeway, and that's exactly what the 115th Congress did, the president did, and now imposing these tariffs, finally trying to get to a solution for all of this and put America on a better level playing field. When you've got, you know, when you've got 25% automobile tariffs that try to get into China and 2-3% tariffs from foreign cars that come in here, you do have a merchandise trade deficit problem. And some of the capital surplus isn't coming back except in the form of funding government with low rate T-bills. So I do think it was time to do something. Now, the president is reaching out to the Farm Belt, which I think is important. They've been suffering from low commodity prices, and another $16 billion on top of a $1 trillion farm bill is going to help. And you could actually say, look, we're going to get quite a bit of revenue from the tariffs. Let's devote that. Let's apply that to the Farm Belt. And I think that would alleviate some of the problems, too, until we get over the hump. But I do think we'll get over the hump.
We've talked about it a number of times on the show, and forgive me if I'm not recollecting, but I don't ever think I've gotten, you know, your take on it. And I would very much appreciate it. When it comes to finding remedies for trade deficits, when finding remedies for trade imbalances, for dealing with IP theft, specifically in the case of China, the president has relied on tariffs, and he's moved to tariffs, and there's reason to think that it's been effective so far. Are there other methods that Jason Lewis, you know, if Jason Lewis were in charge and your priority was remedying these imbalances and these trade deficits, is there another method besides tariffs that you would lean towards?
Well, sure. There's all sorts of subsidies we send abroad. We defend other countries that should be defending themselves in Europe and elsewhere. There's all sorts of other most favored nation status designations that we could clamp down on. But in the final analysis, what you really want is a free trade world with zero tariffs. But you can't do that if you're the only one playing the game.
Yeah.
So you've got to say, look, this is where we want to go. We want to have Chinese imports coming to America, and we want exports going to China, but we're not going to do it in a one-way street. The great irony of all of this is the policy and the politics of Democrats going back decades. Dick Gephardt ran for president in 1988 on this exact policy, on fair, not free trade. That was standard Democrat orthodoxy. And now they've done a 180 in favor of this sort of globalist world trading system that really doesn't put America's interests first in many cases. And if you want Silicon Valley to become Shanghai Valley, then keep doing what you're doing, because when they get a particular device or a particular operating system or what have you, and they re-engineer it from the ground up from theft, you are going to have a serious, serious problem. And it's not just going to be economic.
Jason Lewis, as always, thank you for the time, sir. It's always great talking with you. Hope you have a fantastic week.
Same to you. Thanks, gang.
We'll talk to you next week.
Hey, real quick, before we wrap things up, got an article here, Andrew, from The Sun.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And apparently, billionaires are trying to live forever. Okay.
I mean, aren't we all?
It's simply not enough for billionaires to have everything they ever wanted, according to the Sun reporter. They need eternity to enjoy it too. One of the suggestions on here, though, Drew, I think for us, Sam might be able to help us out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, okay, this might seem like something out of
her fresh young blood.
Hello, it's me.
You're 100% correct.
Oh,
there are companies out there conducting trials into the effects of blood transfusions, transfusing blood from the young and healthy people. specifically with those between the ages of 16 and 25.
These people have watched way too many vampire movies.
Into those who feel like they're getting on in years and could reverse aging.
Nope.
So there you go.
I'm not a scientist. I'm not a doctor. But I'm going to give that a big old fat.
You don't think that's how it works?
Right from the get-go. No, I don't think that's how it works. I don't think putting younger blood in your body reverses the aging of all of your organs.
I don't think it would reverse it.
That's
but
what
maybe
he said.
Like,
yeah. That's what they're seeking.
Down, maybe.
Right, why? How? Why?
Right, give me some of your blood.
No, stay away from my blood.
Give me some of your blood.
No.
I want to see.
No, I'll give you some blood.
Look, you've clearly got extra.
See if it gets rid of the dark marks under my eyes.
No,
okay, fine.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
If you needed a blood transfusion, John, as a friend, I would definitely do that for you.
Your type doesn't match?
Yes.
especially
if our blood type doesn't match.
Yeah, I don't even
you know
know
your blood type?
No.
Yeah, John, I assume you know yours.
I do not know mine.
How do you not know yours?
I know, I really should. I know, I don't. I just do what's necessary.
You know, your doctors know your blood type, and that's all that matters.
I know I got to test it to see how thin it is, and that's what I need to know. When I do that, I do not know what type it is.
All right.
Yeah.
You should probably get on that.
Yeah,
Do you know your blood type, Drew?
No.
What?
You should probably get on that.
Yeah, Drew, get on that. I feel like it's one of those things that you should know about yourself.
Yeah, I feel like you're right.
But why?
Well, tomorrow on the show, everybody's blood type.
Yay!
Yay!
Plus comedians Tim Slagle and Brian Miller. Have a great day.